Okay, I'll say it because it's kind of an easy way to begin, and it's turn with me, if you will, to the place where this week's Torah portion begins. It's actually chapter 25 now of the book of Exodus, or Shemot, and as usual, it starts with the words that repeat all the time and therefore don't really end up being given the name of the parsha. It says, "And Yahuwah spoke unto Moshe." And here come the words in red, and of course, this is where we're going to find the first word that's kind of unique. Tells us how the parsha is going to be named. It says, "Speak unto the children of Israel." Well, we've heard that pretty frequently too. And tell them what? That they take for me an offering. Of every man whose heart makes him willing, you shall take my offering. And this, it says, is the offering which you shall take of them, gold and silver and brass. And we know that this word take there, it's it appears in a couple different forms. It's got to do with the verb conjugation, but lechach, right? In this case, it's techach. It's actually techachu. Tell them all, y'all take my offering. And this offering, terumah, has to do with something which is lifted up, or a heave offering, exalted, rise up. So there's an indication of up in here into this idea of take up for me an offering too, terumah. Okay, so that's the name of the Torah portion. And with that, I want to pause. I'm going to do some things that are a bit different tonight than what I would normally do on a Erev Shabbat. And normally, of course, what I do is try to go through more or less in order the entire Torah portion. Not that we're not going to do that. It's just that there are some other elements, and I'll probably take a little bit more liberty with the specifics tonight because, well, a couple reasons. One, because we're going to see several Torah portions in a row now that have to do with the creation, the building of the Mishkan, the tabernacle in the wilderness, the great big tent that is a movable tabernacle. And what is interesting, of course, and here's where I digress a little bit from the straight text, and that is that this narrative has often been called a creation narrative. And in that respect, it's kind of interesting for several reasons. First one, of course, is that if you look at the creation narrative in Genesis, depending upon where you count it and in which part you're looking, you could argue that it's only about 34 verses or so long. So the entire heavens and the earth created in about 34 verses. Maybe that's because Yah knew what he was doing, and it doesn't take as much verbiage for him to describe, because we wouldn't understand it anyway, especially when he's making something out of nothing. All right, so there's that element. But ultimately, this creation narrative here, which transcends not only this Torah portion, but the next couple, is thus many, many times longer for the creation of a single place where he will literally put his presence than the entire creation of the heavens and the earth. And that's kind of fascinating. Well, I've already alluded to the fact that, well, maybe it's because he has to tell men how to do it. So there's that element. There are a number of other things about this creation concept that are particularly interesting. And if you think about it, this is the part that really kind of fascinates me. In the creation of the entire heavens and the earth, you could argue that this is something that exists, if you will, because in and out don't make much sense in the concept of a universe which is so huge and everything we can conceive of is in it. But there might be something, which is, of course, the Creator himself, which is outside of it. Where is that? Well, we can't really quite wrap our heads around it. But think of it this way. He creates a universe, an entire universe, and within that a world, within that which we can live. And here, within the world that he's already created for us, men are going to create a little teeny place, kind of a snippet of something that he will in fact fill up as his place in and amongst them, where I will dwell among them. And I find that kind of fascinating. So we're going to get a lot of description about how to do that. And as I've already alluded to, again, it arguably takes more description for him to tell us how to do something and to do it right than it does for him to just do it and then tell us about it, because so much of it we wouldn't understand. Now, there are some other elements to this that are important. And one that, well, I saw an interesting way it was phrased. I thought about it a number of times. It certainly makes sense. And you see this in a number of places here, because we're actually going to get this creation of the Mishkan narrative more or less twice. Okay, once tell them what to do and then telling them what they did. But I saw this referred to just literally within the last couple days as the IKEA effect. Now, I'm not a big IKEA person. There's one of these in Denver. I'm not even sure if we've ever actually... I think I've been in the store. But some of you know what IKEA is. It's IKEA, and I think it's a European company, right? And their thing basically is that they make all of this fancy and relatively expensive furniture, some assembly required. So the key is that people actually have to put it together themselves. And it was Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sachs that wrote about it, but in the process, he basically is quoting a fellow named Dan Ayerly, who is a behavioral economist. I find that kind of interesting. A behavioral economist. In other words, he looks at economics based on the way people act and behave. And essentially, he calls the IKEA effect this idea that people seem to value something if they put their own, well, labor into it. And he quoted some research where people are asked to learn how to make origami, and they make origami, and they do a piece, and then they're asked what would they be willing to pay to keep it. And they're a lot more always willing to pay to keep the thing that they made than they are the one which is almost identical to it, but somebody else made it. And that says a lot. So as this behavioral economist says, we overvalue, certainly we value, that which we make ourselves. And furthermore, the more labor you put into it, the more we tend to love it. Now, I can relate to that because certainly when we build something, around a working ranch or a house, or you design something and build it, you do have an appreciation for it. And the harder it was, the more appreciation you seem to have. So all of that makes a lot of sense to me. Hence, the introduction to the Mishkan. Because it seems like the Creator who made us pretty well understands how we are anyway. He's thinking here, obviously, look, if these people will make something, will build, and will provide the materials out of the donations that they make out of their own hearts, if they will make that for me, then they'll think more of it. More labor, more love. There's another element of this. Not only is there a role reversal of the innies and the outies, he makes a place for us, arguably within him, to dwell. Then we make a little place within our universe that he made for us in which he can put his presence. So there's a role reversal there, and there's this role reversal too at this point in the story, and that is, up until now, everything we've seen in Exodus has been basically Yah doing something for the B'nai Israel. Whether it's plagues or delivering them by a mighty hand and doing all the miracles, it was something he did, including providing water and manna in the wilderness and so forth. Well, now, the role reversal in this element is he's done all the work, their turn. They're going to do some work themselves. Now, here is where I... I tell you what. Let's just spend a few minutes. We'll talk about some elements of the story. And then I'll pause and kind of go where I really want to go. I think it'll make more sense if I give a little bit of the background of the story here. So we've already had Yahuwah speaking to Moshe, saying, speak to the children of Israel, tell them the following. Going to take for me an offering. I'm going to come back to this verse, 2 and 3. Because the word take in there in the Hebrew is used three different times. And Rashi, who I've always admired, says if you look at the Hebrew phrasing, and it's actually kind of, well, you don't even see it in English at all, but if you look at the Hebrew phrasing, two of these are obligatory. One of them is voluntary. I don't see it in the English. But he makes an interesting case, and it certainly also fits with this idea of more labor, more love, and making things ourselves. And it has to do a little bit with the way that we give, too. And that's the theme that I think is important. We'll come back to that, like I said, because what I want to do first is talk about some of the things that are going to get given. Here is the offering which you're going to take from them. Gold, silver, brass, purple, blue, scarlet, fine linen, goat's hair, ram skins, dyed red, seal skins, acacia wood, oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil, sweet incense, lots of stones, onyx stones, stones to be set for the ephod and for the breastplate, and let them make for me a sanctuary. A mishkan is the Hebrew word there. And actually is mikdash in this verse. Mikdash. That I may dwell among them. According to all that I show you, the pattern is going to be laid out here. Hence, a lot of verbiage and the pattern of all the things for the tabernacle, the Mishkan itself, and for the furniture. Here's how you're going to do it. And literally, what we're going to see here is a blueprint. And the first thing that we get talked to about is how to make the ark. That word in Hebrew is aron. And we're going to actually see a couple different kinds of arks, but an aron of acacia wood. 2.5 cubits long by 1.5 cubits wide and 1.5 cubits high. And we're going to overlay it with pure gold and make about it a crown of gold around it, put some rings around it. Everything basically inside and outside is going to be pure gold. And the idea here is that these staves, these wooden things which stay in it, they are never to be taken from it. Says Rashi, not ever. They are how it is to be carried. And then it describes the ark cover, and it too is going to be a pure gold. And we know that upon it are going to be two cherubim, cherubs in the English, one cherub, two cherubim of beaten work, and they are on opposite sides of the ark cover, and they face one another. They got wings, and they screen it. And essentially, the other claim here is that so as the cherubim faced one another over the mercy seat on the Aron, the ark, also that is how the Kohanim, which carried it. They carried it facing one another, too. And there it says, I'll meet with you and I'll speak with you from above the ark cover, from above the two cherubim. And we're going to talk about some other things. Key here now. This description moves from the inside and arguably the most important out. Interesting way to start, right? A lot of times if we're talking about a blueprint, you'd think, all right, well, you know, you build a house, you start with the foundation, then you lay the framing work. If it's a wood-framed house, you frame it up first, and then you build towards the inside. Put a roof on it, and then you cover the outside, then you work on the inside. Last thing you do, you finish up the kitchen and all that kind of stuff. Here's just the opposite. Starting from the most important, from the ark inside, and ultimately this is going to be called the Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies, the most set-apart place, working on outward. And this, of course, is the place where he says, I will meet with you. Then we get description of some other things, of the table of acacia wood, and the description about it. Now, it, too, is going to be a whole lot of gold, pure gold, covered with gold, made out of acacia wood. That's the kind of common thread here. Most of this furniture is made out of acacia wood, and it's covered with gold, pure gold, beaten work. And in a lot of cases, there are also going to be rings on the outside, four rings of gold that are used with a set of staves to carry it. There's dishes, pans, jars, bowls. All of these out of gold, too. Then we get this table of showbread. There's going to be a description of a menorah, a candlestick out of pure gold, beaten work. And this is kind of fascinating because this thing is heavy. And I have heard it said, and I'm not going to argue with the metallurgist, that literally it couldn't be done today. The metallurgists just plain don't have the skill set to take a single piece of essentially a talent of pure gold. And as I can tell, that's pretty heavy. We're talking about 50, 60, 70 pounds, depending upon whose number you believe. But let's call it around a rough $1 million in today's suppressed price of gold for this one menorah. And it's going to have all these elements on it, right? The knops and the flowers, almond blossoms. And it's going to be beaten from one single piece of pure gold. Wow, tough. The Midrash actually claims that Moshe was stymied, tried, worked hard, and couldn't get it done. Now, I'm not sure if I believe this because this is extra biblical. But eventually, when he had tried really, really hard and couldn't quite get it to working, and they couldn't figure out how to do it, the claim is, well, Elohim stepped in and helped him. But somehow or other that fits with this concept of the theme of they had to try it first, try to put some work into it, more labor, more love. And at the point where he finally then steps in and helps them, at least they've had the opportunity to give it their best shot. All right, we've got more vessels that are described, and then the tabernacle itself, as we move on to chapter 26, is going to be made. And we start here with the idea of how it's going to be covered. 10 curtains, fine twine linen, blue, purple, and scarlet, along with the cherubim, the work of the skillful workmen, you shall make them. Each of them's 28 cubits long and 4 cubits wide. So 28 cubits, upwards of 40 feet long, and about 4 cubits, a little bit over 6 feet wide. Now, the way it's usually described, although I've seen and I've talked in years past about some people that say, no, the shape of this thing may be radically different because it's not really told to us. And there are those that say it might be some kind of a geodesic dome structure, and some pretty interesting observations on that score. Well, maybe we'll talk about that later because we're going to go through this several times. But in any case, if you've seen the drawings, the standard drawing is kind of what looks like an airplane hangar, just a rectangular structure, and these long curtains are draped over it, essentially from side to side. They cover the top and hang down. They're going to have loops of blue along the edge, and 50 loops in one curtain, 50 loops in the second, set opposite one another, clasps of gold, and curtains of goat's hair for the tent over the tabernacle, 11 curtains of those, each of those 30 cubits long, a little bit longer, and the breadth of them, 4 cubits. They're all the same, basically. And couple 5 of them by themselves and 6 curtains, so they're divided into sets. Again, 50 loops and 50 clasps of brass, and the description of how they hang together and hang over the back of the tabernacle is provided next. Make a covering for the tent. So we've got layer upon layer here. Covering for the tent of ram skins dyed red, and a covering of seal skins above. Now, some of these names, admittedly in the Hebrew, and I think it's the word that's translated in English as seal skin there. I've seen a scholarship that indicates, we're not really sure what this animal is, but probably wasn't a kind of a seal that you see at SeaWorld. The lengths of those are described. And then we're going to talk about the boards that make up the tabernacle, also of acacia wood, 10 cubits long, so 15 feet long, about cubit and a half wide. These are pretty good-sized boards. 20 boards on the south side, and under them are going to be sockets of silver under each of the 20 boards on one side. And on the second side, north side, 20 boards, so 40 sockets of silver, 2 under each board. And the hind part of the temple going to have its own set of acacia wood boards and so forth. Describes how it's all going to be put together. Again, with these sockets of silver underneath of them. Bars of acacia wood, 5 for the one side of the tabernacle, 5 for the other side of the tabernacle. And how that's going to be put together. Some of these are going to be overlaid with gold and make their rings of gold for holders over the bars and overlay the bars with gold. Set up the tabernacle, it says in verse 30 of chapter 26, according to the fashion that has been shown to you, speaking to Moshe, right, up on the mount. And then we're going to have a veil of blue, purple, and scarlet, fine twine linen, with cherubim, the work of the skillful workman, it shall be made. And you'll hang it upon the 4 pillars of acacia overlaid with gold, their hooks of gold, upon those 4 sockets on the bottom of silver. And it's basically going to be set up. This curtain is going to divide the holy place, the place that is just called Kodesh, from the place that is the Kodesh Kodeshim. And he put the ark cover on the ark of the testimony in the most holy place, set the table outside the veil, candlestick over against the table, and set the tabernacle, candlestick over against the table on the side of the tabernacle towards the south, put the table on the north side. Make that screen for the door of the tent of blue, purple, scarlet, and fine twined linen, work of the weaver in colors. And make for the screen 5 pillars of acacia. Overlay those 2 with gold hooks and sockets of brass. Let's pause there. So we've got a pretty detailed description through several chapters of all the pieces of this tabernacle. Again, working from the inside out. Interesting. And we're going to get more description in the weeks to come. The last chapter, which I haven't talked about yet, has to do with the altar of acacia wood, 5 cubits by 5, and the horns of the altar. Funny that we would go kind of inside out, now we're going to have this one other element of the altar, which literally marks kind of a transition zone too, doesn't it? Now, at this point, I'll pause and I'll make a reference or two to interesting teachings on this. This kind of sets off where I want to go. I've talked about this one before, too. Rabbi David Foreman, a fellow that I find very interesting and readable and listenable, has made the point, you know what? If you look at the tabernacle, you can kind of make a pretty good case that it's like a face. Like there are elements that would correspond to elements of a human face. And maybe that makes sense. We're making a place for him to dwell among us. There are many references, even in the Shema and in the Aaronic blessing and other places, to the Panim, right? Let his face to shine upon you. Even though we don't know what his face looks like, somehow or other it seems like there's a representation here, is his claim. And I'll go through it quickly. Again, I'm setting the stage because I think there are a number of elements of this that are particularly fascinating. Well, let's start with the first thing that the scripture starts with. The ark is described. What's inside the ark? Well, the commandments are going to be in there. The tablets of stone. So his claim is that the ark and the cherubim covering it and the place where his presence comes up and the literally the central focus of all of this is kind of akin to a human brain. Makes sense to me. This is the central focus. This is the place where the thinking is done, the communication is done. All right, I'll go with that. What next? You got two things that are basically side by side as you move out from the inner Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies. One is the menorah, candlestick, lamps, seven lights. What is the purpose of a menorah? Well, it's give light. That's how you can see inside of this area here. All right, well, so if the menorah gives off light, what would be the obvious parallel to that? Well, that certainly looks like something that might be associated with vision or with eyes. Wait a minute. There's two things that are basically in parallel there as we move out from the Kodesh Kodeshim. The other one is this table of showbread. And right there in the name, showbread, the idea of the bread that is going to be put in there for show for a full week. How do you look at something? What is the purpose of showing something like showbread? Well, so you can see it. Another reference, it would seem, to the eye. So now we got two things. One that is the light for vision, and the other is something to see with it. Two eyes. That makes sense. What's next? Well, this smaller altar of incense. Oh, gee, that's obvious, isn't it? What is the purpose of making incense? Well, it's for a sweet smell. If there's not an association with the nose there, okay, I don't know what is. And finally, we come to the place that we're just now talking about, this altar. And the idea that this is the place where these sacrifices will be offered. And again, what's going to happen to the sacrifices? They're going to be consumed upon the altar. So, yeah, I suggest some. Hey, can you see a parallel there with the concept of a mouth? Well, it's an interesting idea anyway. So I'm going to set that on the table and say, what else do we have that is interesting about this portion and this long, and some would even say this long, repetitive, boring description? And I'm going to come back to one other element in tomorrow's discussion, probably, and that is that when I see things that, in particular, when I see repetitions, right, beaten works of pure gold, the references to how the coverings are to be made, the blue, purple, scarlet, fine woven linen, the work of the weaver, a lot of those phrases are repeated almost word for word. And as an engineer and with a background in mathematics and information theory and coding and error correction, I can't help but think, wow, that speaks redundancy. And since there is no idle word in Torah, you have to ask, why is there redundancy? I can think of several reasons. One, because sometimes we're pretty dense, we're not paying attention. Another one, because maybe there's extra information in there. Lots of information, even if it doesn't seem like it. Okay, so what's my point? Well, people tend to look at this portion and go, oh, I can skip over this. All of this boring stuff about making a tabernacle, a place for him to dwell. And yet, as we've already outlined, there is a lot of interesting in and out role reversal. Inside the universe, where he puts a place for us, we put a place for him. Yeah, fascinating stuff. Which brings me to, not just the face metaphor, but standard Christianity 101. What'll you hear about this thing, the tabernacle, they might call it, or the tabernacle in the wilderness? Most people don't seem to use the term Mishkan, although I do think there's a lot to be said for understanding the Hebrew and recognizing it. But the tabernacle's not, we don't care about it, right? That was just out there in the old Mosaic covenant time. Well, that's done away with anyway. Nothing Moses did really matters. You've heard all of that, and you know what my reaction is to that. That's BS. Bad stuff. Bogus eschatology. Bogus, you name it. I'm trying to be polite here. But it really is bad stuff. Because, of course, the Mashiach says, ain't nothing, not the tiniest part, not one yod or tittle of his Tanakh, in particular his Torah, his instruction, and his writings, the words of the prophets, that is going to pass away as long as heaven and earth still exist. Talk about a creation story, and the two witnesses that Moshe called, they're still there. So for all of those reasons, I'm going to say, no, it's not true. There is something really, really important here. Well, what is the other thing we'll hear in Christianity? Oh, if there ever was a tabernacle, a holy of holies, not to worry, it's inside me. He dwells in my heart. Well, great. Is it as set apart as the holy of holies? We'll come back to that concept. Is it as set apart as the holy of holies? In other words, since Paul correctly says, Shaul, work out your own salvation with fear and trembling, I'm going to suggest, gently at first and then perhaps a little bit more forcefully, that there are a lot of elements of traditional waystream Christianity that have been overblown and indeed twisted to the point where we don't even know much about this Mishkan anymore, this tabernacle. Is it really inside people that claim it is? Well, if they don't know the Torah, and I hearken here to Matthew 7:23, where Yeshua says, many will come to me in that day and say, Lord, Lord, hey, didn't we do all this good stuff in your name, cast out demons in your name, and in your name do all these wonderful works? His response, depart from me, you who are without Torah. I never knew you. Never yadad you. How is it that people can claim, you know, he's dwelling inside me, that dwelling place is in there? If his response is, I never knew you. It seems to me like there is something of real importance here that often gets overlooked. And with that, with the idea of, we're told, I don't need no stinking tabernacle, don't have to study this, don't have to worry about it, it's all inside me. Again, is it really? I want to go back to the IKEA effect. We overvalue, said this behavioral economist, we overvalue what we make ourselves. Do we overvalue this tabernacle that we claim we've made in ourselves and we haven't put any real effort into it? What did he say? More labor, more love. I'll ask it this way. Is there any real effort? Any real effort required to claim there's a tabernacle in there? I said the prayer once. Once and done. Don't have to actually do anything. Yahushua says, if you love me, keep my commands. We say, at least the church says, no, don't. Don't worry about it. Don't worry about Sabbath. We don't do that anymore. Don't worry about his commandments having to do with food, especially meat, because we don't worry about that anymore. We don't worry about much of anything, he says, it would seem. A few things may still matter that didn't get changed in the New Testament. The more you look and the more you learn and the more you see about what it really says and how far we've come from it, I can't help but think something is very central with this idea of the tabernacle and making a dwelling place in the whole universe. Now, I'm not going to deny that there are certainly elements, and I think that that's a really valuable concept of He dwells within our hearts. Great. But there's something about this dwelling place in our hearts that often gets overlooked. It is supposed to be the Kodesh Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies. If it's not particularly pure, if it's not particularly clean, if we haven't really made any effort to make a place in there for Him, haven't even bothered to learn Torah, don't even bother to keep His Sabbaths, His Moedim, do what He says, we're filling this body up full of crap that He says isn't even food, and doing all kinds of other things that He calls abomination, can we really make the claim that there's something in there that is Kodesh, Kodeshim, the Holy of Holies? For crying out loud, in the center of the Aron, the Ark, are the Ten Commandments. Most people don't even buy. Well, there's four or five of them still matter. I think you see the point anyway. I keep coming back to this idea of the more work it takes, the more love we have. And where is it supposed to be? In our hearts. And if we're not really making any effort to construct that tabernacle, or even pay any attention to how the first one there in the wilderness was constructed, because it's boring and we don't care about that anyway, I can't help but think maybe we're missing a large part of the point. All right, with that, I want to spend just a couple of minutes on one more story that I saw, another Midrash. And this one was, it has a couple different elements to it. And I'm really just going to hit a couple of the high points, because I've really made the point already that I'm going to come back to this idea of comparing, if you will, the Torah observant. Let's study the Mishkan thing from the, we don't need to. All that's Old Testament stuff anyway. And any tabernacle I ever needed, it's in there somewhere. Yep, he dwells within me. Because I said that prayer once and done. I'm looking at a piece by Rabbi Yehoshua. Isn't that interesting? Yehoshua Berman. And it's called What Really Counts. And I've alluded to this, but now I'll go back and pick it up. This is a Rashiism, the claim that in those first couple of verses here, Exodus chapter 25, verses 2 and 3. What is it? The first words in red. Speak to the children of Israel and tell them that they take for me terumah. Every man whose heart makes him willing, you shall take my offering. And this is the offering which you shall take of them or from them. Gold and silver and brass and blue and purple and scarlet and fine linen and goat's hair and the remaining list of stuff. Now, this really resonated with me in this concept of thinking about comparing, if you will, Christianity and this Mishkan within me with elements of the construction of the tabernacle itself and the Ikea effect. So we're tying a bunch of these things together. See if this doesn't kind of fit. Rashi, again, is the one that says, if you look and study the Hebrew, and I won't go through it because, honestly, I'm not sure that I completely follow it. But basically, there are implications in the way that those verses are phrased. They vary a little. It's repeated three times. That we can get, this root word that has to do with lakach, or to take in the Hebrew. So it gets translated to English three times as take. Take a contribution, an offering from the people. And Rashi says this, if you really sit down and look at it, there's an implication. Two of the three takes are obligatory. Take these things. And the third take is voluntary. And how much is dependent, and we can see this one, an offering of each man, every man, whose heart makes him willing. So we got two mandatory or obligatory contributions and one that is dependent upon each person's heart. That's a place that some of us claim, he dwells. Their individual desire to give. So Rashi says that means there's three different categories of contribution. Now the obligatory contribution, number one anyway, was the silver. For the thing that is called in the Hebrew the adanim, these heavy sockets that anchor the vertical planks that make up the walls of the Mishkan. Okay, so we got these sockets, heavy sockets, where the wood parts basically fit into the base, the structure. And there's also an obligatory contribution for the purchase of korban, the continuing offerings. And one voluntary contribution for the rest, everything else, of the Mishkan. Each according to his own heart. So how do we relate to all of this? And basically what the rabbi here spends some time developing is the concept that, look, you know, whether you're talking Christianity or Rabbinic Judaism or so many other things, great libraries, edifices, public buildings, fancy stuff, you name it, people like to give their money where it makes a big showy entrance. All right, so if you want to finance a building, everybody wants to give to the main study hall, the grand entrance lobby, the big place where maybe they put their name on a little gold plaque and say, so-and-so and Mr. and Mrs. so-and-so all contributed to this grandiose entry here. On the other hand, there are a couple things that just aren't particularly sexy, we would say, in the modern English twisting. Obligatory maintenance is one of them. Now that this building is built, takes continuing money, generous contributions to keep the water in the pipes and the heat going and the electricity going and the maintenance, the janitors, and so forth. That's not particularly glamorous. Nobody wants to do that. And furthermore, you got this great big fancy building underneath that main study hall and grand entrance lobby. You know, there's a pump room, and there's a maintenance shack and a janitorial closet. There's probably a crawl space. And nobody wants to say, I gave my money for the creation of the crawl space or the janitor's closet. It's not nearly as high-profile desirable. So, let's look at human nature and what it reveals here in this idea of these three types of gifts, teruma, for the construction of the Mishkan. No need to mandate contributions for the showy main structure, the part that everybody sees, because the attraction of contributing towards the creation of the beautiful tapestries, the work of the workman, the clothing of the Kohanim, the splendidly gorgeous utensils, the gold that covers all the things, the Holy of Holy itself, all that. Wow, that's moving stuff. A lot of people want to contribute to that, handsomely even. On the other hand, remember those silver sockets? Those are located at the very bottom end of the Mishkan, kind of like the janitor's closet or the crawl space. They might not have been as attractive for donors. So, in the both of those two cases, continuing stuff, continuing sacrifices, continuing maintenance costs, and the stuff that's not quite as showy, there was an obligatory command. Take these things. They don't have the gleam of the precious metals and the precious stones. So, to provide for the nitty-gritty continuing operational costs and bottom structural parts, it was necessary to make those obligatory. So let's cut to the chase. See how all of this fits together. Now, everybody, he says, this is the rabbi again speaking, wants to experience the meaning in life. We like to feel that we have true significance in our lives. Now, again, the IKEA effect, more labor, more love. We're going to participate in the creation of something grandiose. Well, it takes a lot of work. And I think when it comes to the work part, as opposed to the contributions part, maybe that's a little bit more clear. I mean, having been through construction and built some things, I know that sometimes the hardest part of the project is not the part that you can see. It's the part that's hidden. You don't do a good job with the structure. You don't do a good job of the things that are in the walls. I used to say when we built a house a long time ago, I'm more concerned about what's in the walls than what's on them. I want to make sure that the plumbing and the electrical work and the insulation, the stuff that's almost impossible to get to once it's up, is well done. And I get a great sense of satisfaction out of that, even though you don't see it. But again, I think it's I'd rather spend money on the parts that you can see. And I don't mind spending time on the parts that you can't. All right, he makes the case that same thing is true. If you maintain a car, it's most people will spend more on polishing it and waxing it and making sure it's really pretty and worrying about a dent than they do whether the engine is sound and the battery works and the oil gets changed. You go on a vacation. How many times can people relate to this? Everybody's all excited about snapping the perfect shot or taking the perfect video to the extent that eventually you're just plain distracted from actually enjoying what you're there to do. You can miss it. So how much more so, here's where I tie the pieces together, how much more so a tabernacle, a mishkan, that no one else can even see? Okay, I'm going back again to this this claim of ex-Christianity. Notice I'm using the term ex-Christianity to differentiate that from the true understanding that, yeah, the scripture from Bereshit, Genesis to maps, all matters. And I don't care what the names are that people describe themselves, but I will contend that what matters is, do we pay attention to the inner stuff that's in us and that's in the scripture, line by line, precept by precept? Or do we just go for the dogma that says, oh, I said the prayer, got my get out of hell free card, tabernacle, mishkan, whatever it is, he dwells within me, end of story. Am I missing something? Well, yeah. If the obligatory contributions are required by the Creator, not the showy part, that's voluntary. The obligatory parts require to do those things that require, A, the foundations, the nitty-gritty basis stuff that everything else is built on, those sockets in which the boards get set, and the continuing, just nasty work of doing the maintenance, paying for the lights and the power, or keeping the korban coming. I'll ask it this way. How much more so, when it comes to the question of the work that we put in, the labor, and the love that it represents, how much more so if it's a tabernacle that we claim is built in our hearts, but nobody else can see it? Nobody else can even tell if it's there. Oh, yeah, it's he dwells in my heart. Oh, really? How can I tell? Do I see your Torah obedience? By your fruits, are you known? In so many respects, these are the elements. It's the hard stuff. It's the nasty stuff. It's the stuff that isn't seen that still needs to be there. And somehow or other, I think most of us can recognize that, we do get to see the fruit. I guess you could say, an analogy, and I hadn't thought of this until just now. You plant a tree in cruddy soil, and it doesn't have the ongoing maintenance, the water, the nutrients that it needs to live. It might not bring forth fruit. The example that I was tempted to use, I'm still going to mention it, but it's pretty nerdy, and sometimes people like my nerdy examples, other times not. But if you've ever studied physics or ever heard the term a black box, I'm going to ask this one. Give me ones on the screen if you've ever heard of a physics thought experiment called Schrodinger's cat. Here? Okay, people know about Schrodinger's cat. What's Schrodinger's cat? Well, the idea was, this physicist said a long time ago, put a cat in a box. Now, it's kind of a cruel-sounding example. Put a cat in a box, black box. And when a physicist says black box, it means no light goes in or out, no electromagnetism goes in or out, nothing goes in or out of this box. Gravity, this box is literally cut off. And there's a cat in there. Well, is there a cat in there? Well, how do you know, right? That's the question. Furthermore, the question that's always asked about Schrodinger's cat is it alive? How do you tell? Can't hear, can't see, can't x-ray it. Does it matter? Well, you'd think it would matter. It matters to the cat, I guess. But if you can't tell, what do we know about it? So that's where I come back to this idea again of the tabernacle, the Mishkan that we claim is in our hearts. If no one can really see it or even tell, if no electromagnetic radiation is able to penetrate and confirm whether there really is anything dwelling in that supposed tabernacle that's inside us, is it really there? The physicists would say it doesn't really matter. And maybe therein lies the rub. Concentration. As we kind of wrap up, and that's really about where I want to wrap up this evening, I'll simply suggest that there is value in this Torah portion that seems kind of boring. And each time I go through it, especially, I guess, since I've really come to understand that it's not boring, and that there are lots of elements in here that we really need to be paying attention to. Because the question is, if we believe, if we have been taught, and I don't have a problem with the claim, right? There is a tabernacle. He can, in fact, dwell within my heart. Have I made a place, though? Has there really been any effort? Is there effort that's still necessary? That sounds like something you can spiritualize away. Now, I'm going to say there's more to it than that. I think there is real value in going through here and looking at the pattern and seeing patterns like, Rabbi Foreman's face, the brain, the eyes, the menorah and the showbread, the incense, that's the nose, and saying, you know what? All of those are elements of how he relates to us. The whole point of this tabernacle thing is for us to build a place in our world that he can dwell within us. Well, that certainly fits, even with the dogma. The question, again, is how much effort are we putting in there? How much voluntary contribution, how much mandatory contribution are we doing to put this place there and to continue then to maintain it too? Remember, it's not enough just to build it and say once and done. He says, if you love me, keep my commandments. It may be boring. maybe a continuing, oh, gee, do I really have to do that? But yeah, the answer is it's part and parcel of why we're here. It's what we're supposed to do. The more labor, the more love. If you love me, keep my commandments. The more labor that goes into that, I think the more sense that we get of understanding what that ahava, that love means.